Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash On Daily for Monday, December 17th, 2018. On today's episode, we're going to talk about what we've been up to at the water cooler. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Managing Editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Writers Hwai Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
Okay, guys, Christmas is coming up next week. Are we almost there?
We are almost there indeed.
8 days away.
So I wanted to ask you guys before we get going, because I don't think we're going to have a water cooler next week because of the holiday, or if we do, it's going to be later in the week. What do you guys have planned for Christmas or for, you know, the holiday?
Last week I mentioned lots and lots of traveling, so that's what I'm doing. I'm bouncing all around the state of Texas for my holidays and taking a few days off, and it's going to be very nice.
I'm going to Florida from the 20th to the 30th to visit with my family and my wife's family, who live very close to each other, which is really nice. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Mostly sticking around here. My family, who used to live a little bit further away in Illinois, have since moved closer, so we don't have quite as long of a Christmas stint away from home as we used to do. But things are a little bit different this year because my grandma on my dad's side of the family, who we usually spend Christmas with on Christmas Day, she lives in assisted living now, and we used to have it at her house. So now that kind of changes things this year, and we're figuring out exactly how we're going to approach it this year and what to do.
I am going to be visited by three ghosts, and I hope they will change my attitude.
Spoiler alert, they won't.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
I feel like there should be a piece of narrative fiction of this, like, on, like, the site, like Chris writing a version of the classic Christmas tale. What are you actually doing, Chris?
Probably nothing. I mean, probably go to my, we'll meet with my family on Christmas Eve. And Christmas Day, my wife and I don't really do anything. Maybe we'll go to the movies, or maybe we'll just hang out. So it'll be a very low key, laid back Christmas.
HD, how about you? This is your first Christmas in New York City.
Well, I'm actually already back home in Northern Virginia with my parents. Yeah. So I can't spend a Christmas away from my family. It's always too much of an event because I have such a big family. So I'm home early because we have a few like family zol. I think I talked about this on the water cooler before, but it's like the death anniversaries for some of my ancestors. So we have that. And then on actual Christmas Day and Eve, we have my dad's side, which is a big potluck. And then my mom's side, which is like an 8-course meal that's like sit down and stuff. So it's always very different Christmases, but a lot of fun.
And I don't know what I'm doing. I have not made any plans yet. But traditionally, I've gone to Chinese restaurants on Christmas. So I'll probably do that. I'll probably break my diet for a day and go to Chinese. But I'm sure we'll catch up with it, what everybody actually did when we come back from the break next week. Let's get into the water cooler. Let's start off with what we've been doing. Jacob, let's start with you. What have you been up to?
Very, very little. I hosted a holiday party. It was very nice. My friends are very nice people. If you're listening, hello, everyone. But more importantly, I've learned the value of slippers. A few weeks ago, I mentioned my wife got me a pair of slippers for our early Christmas, and now I wear them every single day, all day. So if you've read a Slash Film article in the past 3 weeks, it has been edited by a man enjoying his slippers in his home. Thank you very much. I like slippers.
Do a lot of your friends listen to the podcast?
I'm not sure if a lot of them do. I know I was at a D&D game over the weekend, and a few of them mentioned that they pop into the Slash Eliminated podcast every so often. I'm not sure if they're, you know, consistent listeners, but they do pop in when they see an episode title that they are interested in.
I know a couple of my friends do listen, and I'm always, like, weirded out, like, should I even mention things I've been up to that I've mentioned on the podcast because I know they listen to the podcast? So, like, am I just repeating myself to them? I don't know. Is that ridiculous?
No, I mean, sometimes it's really special to hear, you know, to know that the stuff you share with them is important enough to be on the podcast.
Yeah, I guess. What have I been up to? I've been trying, I think I've talked about this on the past on the podcast. I am an amateur magician. I'm trying to get together an act to perform at the Magic Castle, not in a professional capacity, but there's like impromptu areas. And, you know, I've been doing magic all my life, but mostly, you know, for friends in casual environments, and not as a big, you know, show. And so to put together like a 20-minute act is kind of tough, especially because I don't know what my character is. I don't know what I want. I don't want this, you know, act of magic to be just like a series of tricks like some magicians do. Like, you know, coming from the world that we come from of, you know, narrative movies and television, I want there to be kind of like a through line, and I want there to be setups and payoffs, and I want it to feel like a cohesive bit of storytelling. Some of my favorite magicians of all time do that. So I've been kind of like for the last year trying to figure out what is my character, what do I want my thing to be about. I've come up with like all sorts of ideas of, you know, one of my ideas was I was going to be this manic, that guy that like doesn't have anything together and the magic's just happening all around me kind of thing. I don't know. I think after talking to a lot of friends about this and, you know, some of my magic friends who know way more than I think I've come to the conclusion, which I know probably seems obvious to you guys, that I'm going to just create an elevated version of myself. So the act is going to be me talking, or the tricks coming organically from things I love, like movies. And this week, for the first time, the reason why I'm bringing this up is I came, there's this trick I've been doing for a while that I've been doing with the storyline of fate and destiny. Is it fate? Is it destiny? Is it, you know, do you have choice? And it's been kind of bland. It's like a, you know, like, I don't know. I guess probably like, it's like the worst written movie. This week reinvented this trick along the premise that, you know, Back to the Future is my favorite movie, which is true. And that I have invented time travel. And instead of using time travel to go into the future to get next week's lottery numbers, I'm using my special powers for a stupid card trick. So I performed that last night at the Magic Castle, and I don't know. The reaction was insane. So I think I'm in the right direction of where I'm going. I just need to figure out more ways to build the magic around my interests. Like, I want to do something with board games, some other stuff with movies. I have an idea for a trick about movie spoilers, which should probably surprise none of you guys. But I don't know. It's going well. I'm very enthused after last night's reaction, and I finally feel like I'm kind of on some sort of track of where I want to go. But
Peter, have you ever considered like doing a YouTube channel where you do card tricks and film yourself?
I have put some of my magic on Instagram. You know, Jacob, sleight of hand is really good in person, but once you videotape it, unless you are exactly perfect, the camera is not forgiving in any way.
And I guess that makes sense.
And especially the magician's tools of misdirection. Like, if you are here in front of me and I'm doing a card trick to you and I ask you a question, you will look up in my face and I can control that. But if I'm on a video, you're just looking at the hands. So it's, I don't know. There is a whole group of YouTube magicians that do very visual stuff, like people like Shin Lim, who are incredible at that. I don't think I'm in that that realm, but I don't know. I do want to eventually do this show, and I think it would be something that Slash Film readers and listeners would like. I want it to be something like that. That would be, you know, for film geeks. So I'm working on that. I'm excited to make some more progress, and maybe someday show you guys. But speaking of magic, HT, you went to the Museum of Illusions, which really doesn't have anything to do with magic. It's more of an Instagram thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was actually pretty fun. And you kind of stole my segue, Peter. I was going to say, speaking of magic, but it's okay. It's the Museum of Illusions in Chelsea, in New York. And it's a museum kind of dedicated to optical illusions, as well as puzzles and just cool immersive experiences, or rather interactive experiences. The whole thing's kind of like a playroom for kids, actually. There are a lot of children just running around, which I know would like... drive Chris crazy, but it was a lot of fun, actually. There's like, you know, an infinity room. There are rooms that give you the optical illusion of making you seem larger or smaller than your friends, ones that make you look like you're tilted. And then like there's one series of mirrors that can make you like basically look half of you and half of your friend, like standing on the other side. So there are a lot of really cool tricks like that, as well as a lot of puzzles that were very distracting. I think I spent a good like hour just playing with puzzles half the time, but it was a really fun experience. And yes, it is definitely an Instagram sort of hotspot. There is one room that gives this sort of kaleidoscopic, not a kaleidoscopic effect. It's like a sort of gives you this really cool like neon colored shadow, and a lot of people were taking pictures there. And I realized I had not dressed for the occasion, because I was like, oh, I'm going to the museum, I don't have to dress up too fancy. But when I went to take a picture there, I was like, wow, I look like a slob. But it was a lot of fun. And there's also one of those, I posted this on my Instagram, but it was a little table where you put your head through and it looks like your body has disappeared. So you have like your head on a platter. So it was really fun. It was good.
You posted that photo so that people couldn't see what you're wearing.
Yes, exactly. Although I posted my other, the Instagram one on like Twitter. So I guess people can see it anyways. It doesn't matter. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's a good like two, three hour experience. It was a little crowded. Especially full of kids who are just like running around and just like falling down half the time because the optical illusions just make you very dizzy. But it was it's a good time, and I recommend it.
I have one question, there's like this infinity room, which you mentioned, which is kind of like a hall of mirrors where it looks like it just goes on and on and on. Is that the infinity room, I assume?
Yes, that's it.
So I'm assuming to be like, it was just you and your friends in that room, at least judging from your Instagram story.
Yes.
How much time do you get in that room? Like, I feel like, is there a huge line? Because
there is a line. You're only allowed maximum 2 minutes in the room, but there's no one like manning it, so you can just kind of chill in there. But then you just kind of get a lot of glares from people when you leave.
Okay, cool. What else have you been up to?
Yeah. So since I was in Chelsea, I decided to use the opportunity to visit the Chelsea market with a few of my friends. My friend was visiting from Boston, so we were hanging out with our other high school friend, and we decided to go to the Chelsea market, which is sort of this shopping mall slash street fair sort of arena that is located in the former National Biscuit Company factory complex, where, fun fact, the Oreo cookie was originally invented and produced. It's this really cool, like, labyrinth and sort of like almost outdoor mall, but it's indoor as well. It's cool. And like there's like restaurants and stores that are all very cute and kind of twee, very hipster looking. But it was a good place to just hang out for the afternoon. And I had the most delicious hand-cut noodles there at this stall, I guess you would say, called Very Fresh Noodles. It's a Chinese and Thai style. It's delicious. So that was a fun, yeah, that was a good afternoon. I spent a lot of time entertaining friends this weekend. So it was that, and then like went to karaoke as well. And I also learned that my friend who I was hanging out with, she had recently moved to New York as well, and she had moved into an apartment that was, in fact, the exterior for the Continental in John Wick. And I thought that was very cool. And she gave me permission to talk about that on the podcast. So, I can't tell you where she lives, but just it's a very fun fact and very like New York fun fact as well.
I'm guessing they didn't use any of the interiors.
They did not. But the exterior apparently was good enough to be shown on John Wick.
Let's move on to what we've been reading. I'm the only one that has been reading stuff this week, apparently. And I use reading lightly because I've been reading comic books. But I'm so swept up into Spider-Man, into the Spider-Verse, that I'm, you know, reading more of these Miles Morales Ultimate Spider-Man comics. I am getting a little peeved. I know I talked with Jacob last week about these kind of like big crossover events kind of interrupting the flow of the story, and it's kind of getting annoying at this point, especially with me binging comics. I'm assuming, you know, I'm like 20 something comics in at this point. I assume, like, you know, these events only come like once a year or something. Is that correct, Jacob?
Traditionally there's one major one a year. But they've started up that recently. They have, like, you know, major events or medium events. So it really depends on what Marvel's up to and how much money they want to take from your pocket this year.
Well, when you're binging it, you know, it seems like they come up every, like, five issues or so or whatever. And it's kind of annoying. But I'm still into it. I'm kind of annoyed. I love and hate this Marvel Unlimited app. I think I talked about this last week, too. You know, it's great because they have almost every single Marvel comic published up until 6 months ago. And they add, you know, 6 months every week. So you can access, like, almost anything. But there's so many limitations to it. Like, you know, you can't subscribe to a comic to find out when a new issue comes out because they want you to still buy the comics. And also, you know, I'm following Miles Morales through the Marvel comics, and this should easily do that, but there's gaps in which I have to go online and search, like, you know, what is the next appearance of Miles Morales in Marvel comics, because, like, it just, like, you know, just stops at a dead end in this app. It's just kind of frustrating. It's almost as if they want me to pay for this app but not actually read the comics. I don't know. And also, after seeing Spider-Verse again, which I'll talk about later, I decided to, you know, I want to see some of these other characters from Spider-Verse. So I tried to read the Spider-Gwen comic, which I started at issue number one, and it felt like I was coming into the middle of a movie. Like, I didn't know what the heck was going on. This is my other problem with comic books, Jacob. Why am I starting at issue one and I feel like I don't know what the situation is?
Yeah, the problem with this, and this is something that I wish the Marvel Unlimited app would do, and why it's a really crummy app, is that Spider-Gwen, the alternate universe version of Gwen Stacy, who's spider-powered, was introduced in another series, another, like, crossover event, I believe. And Spider-Gwen number one is a direct continuation of those events from when we first last saw her. And rather than the app having a functionality to say, hey, you should read this first, all it does is present you with this number one issue that like makes you think you're getting a complete story when you're not. So it is a combination of really crappy publishing tactics, which is pretty number one on something that's not number one, but also an app that is not made to actually help you understand the world you're trying to enter in any way whatsoever.
You know what's more frustrating is they have like this, you know, news feed in the app where they publish content. Like, I'm sure there's writers like us, you know, creating these things. And there's this one post on there that was this week that, you know, launched me into this that had, you know, where to start off. If you're loving Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, you know, what comics should you read? So for Spider-Gwen, it launched me into this issue one, where it should have launched me into that miniseries that you mentioned. I don't know.
Yeah, this is actually a huge problem, not just with the app, but with comics in general, where every single time something needs a boost or they want to sell something, they'll put number one on it, they'll renumber it and make it a new volume. And it's gotten to the point where Marvel does this so often that it's gotten ridiculous, because every time it's like, oh, we want to boost this character, we want to make sure we sell enough, we want to give this character some sort of collectible value, we'll stick number one on it. Number one has ceased to mean anything, and you kind of have to do homework and research to figure out, where do I start? I mean, it's reached a point where they recently canceled the ongoing Miles Morales Spider-Man series and just relaunched it last week with a new number one Miles Morales series. I mean, it's the same ongoing story, more or less. I mean, it's a new team, but it's meant to be like, you know, right, one right after the other. But it's still now a new number one, maybe 2 years after the previous number one. So you have all these number ones and no way of cleanly figuring out your reading order. It is extremely frustrating.
The other thing I learned is I was like, you know, all these other Spider-Man exist in these alternate universes. I assume that these have been characters that have been in the comics for many years now. And it turns out that most of them were invented in 2014 in a miniseries called Edge of the Spider-Verse. So, you know, Spider-Man Noir appears for the first time there. Penny Parker, the Japanese-American student who pilots the biomech suit thing, I guess it's called SPDR. She was also created for that miniseries by, what's his name? The guy that did Umbrella Academy. He's the of My Chemical Romance, Gerard Way?
I think. Yeah, Gerard Way.
So it's interesting. The only character in that movie other than Spider-Man that actually has a real comic, you know, back history is Peter Porker.
Unless you go to the closing credit stinger, which I won't spoil here.
Yes, yes. So that as well, too. Anyways, I think I'm probably taking up enough time with comics. Probably people who don't read comics are probably annoyed at this. So let's move on to what we've been watching. Jacob, let's start with you.
I caught a screener of Can You Ever Forgive Me, the drama, maybe sort of dry comedy starring Melissa McCarthy. And this is a movie that I put off watching because I thought there's no way it's going to be something I would love. And it turns out I really loved it. It is based on the true story of of Lee Israel, a writer in the early 90s who's fallen out of favor. Her publisher and agent don't want anything to do with her anymore. She's living on pennies. She's about behind on rent. And she learns about the very valuable world of celebrity letters written by dead movie stars and dead entertainers. And she embarks on a career to start forging them and selling them for $100 a piece. And it ends up being this really wonderful, funny, and eventually dark in the right ways story of the lowest of low rent crime. And Melissa McCarthy is absolutely wonderful here. Whenever she's not being directed by her husband to be like a trashy comedic persona, she's such a gifted performer and also just as good as Richard E. Grant as her friend who helps her out and becomes her partner in crime. He's a sort of they're both alcoholics. They're both gay. They're both, you know, creative types who are barely getting by in early 90s New York. And it's just this wonderful, wonderful dynamic between the two of them. And watching these two share the screen is just a gift. Like, I never thought Richard E. Grant, Melissa McCarthy, playing these really catty New York City writers who have no money would be as entertaining as it is. But this movie is such a joy, and I wish it got a bigger response. I wish I'd seen it earlier so I could have championed it earlier. And I really hope that Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy get the awards recognition they deserve, because this is a truly, like, nice movie. I feel nice is a bad word sometimes. It feels like it implies that maybe something's lesser, like it just gets the job done just fine. But for a movie about crime and about people who are really sad, this is a movie so full of nice moments and sweet moments and human moments. Like, there's a scene where, or a sequence where Richard E. Grant helps Melissa McCarthy's character clean her apartment. And it sounds like it shouldn't be as, like, heartwarming as it is, but it ends up being a great portrait of friends helping friends in a way that I found really moving. And I know I'm not the only one here who saw this. Does anyone else want to pipe in on Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I think I actually talked about it last week, and yeah, everything you said is 100% accurate. It's a fantastic movie, and it's, you know, like you said, when movies like this happen, it makes me a little upset that Melissa McCarthy is, like, wasting her talent. But at the same time, she's also making a lot of money, so I guess she doesn't really care that much. But she makes so many, like, bargain basement, you know, fall down comedies that are awful. And, you know, she has real range, and I wish she had the chance to use it more often, because she's so good at this.
Well, I'll go and bring up the elephant in the room, the movie that everybody saw that we're all going to talk about, and that is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I was skeptical when Peter and Ben both told me it's one of the best movies of the year. I thought, okay, it's going to be good. I'm going to enjoy this movie, but it's not going to be the best movie of the year. Come on, that's crazy talk. And I saw it, and I can say without hesitation now, it is the best superhero movie ever made. It is in consideration for my top five of the year. Maybe even top three. I'm really, really battling with myself right now over where it falls. But a movie, strip away that it's a Spider-Man superhero movie, it is, has an unreal animation style. I've never seen anything that looks like this before. The tactile sense of a drawing come to life and rendered into a three-dimensional world, I've never seen it done this well. It is immaculate to look at. But also, the screenplay is such a model of condensed, thoughtful, like, witty, smart storytelling. The amount of exposition and character building and world building done quickly and invisibly in this movie is beyond anything I've seen in a long time. And the animation helps. I think the animation helps them speed things along faster than a live action movie could have, but it is just, the level of storytelling on here is, I've never seen anything achieve what this movie achieves in terms of the amount of story, heart, character, information, laughs, promise squeezed in every single second here. I love superheroes, so it's an easy mark for liking this, but it is the craft of the filmmaking that elevates it into being some kind of grand work of pop art, not just a great Spider-Man movie, but a movie about superheroes as a symbol and about how we understand and contextualize superheroes in our culture, and how malleable that is, and how it takes the idea of there being multiple Spider-Men from different dimensions coming together as a commentary on how Spider-Man can be anything to anyone and how anybody can be under that mask. And it is just this really beautiful, amazing, hilarious thing. And I'm going to toss the baton to somebody else, because I know we all love this movie. Who else wants to talk about Spider-Man?
I'm going to say, actually, I'm the only one who hasn't seen it yet. I need to, I know, but just to put that out there in case of spoilers.
I think Peter and I have already talked about it. Peter, you rewatched it, though, right? Actually, yeah. Brad, you saw it for the first time, right?
Yeah.
I did.
Okay, so what did you think?
There's not really much more that I can say that Jacob didn't already say. Except, like, I also was just so floored by how great this movie was. It was even better than I thought it could be. I've been saying since the first trailer that this movie came out that I hoped that this would be a sort of game changer and open up the door for us to be able to see the kinds of comic book stories that aren't easy to adapt in live action form. And this is a perfect example of that, because it brings to life characters that fans never thought they would ever see in a movie, and it does it in a way that's exciting and hilarious and original, and it's such a cool collection of characters. And, like, I think it does something as far as like diversifying the superhero genre even more so than Black Panther does. Like Black Panther is undoubtedly this crowning achievement, you know, for superheroes because it puts this prominent black cast on display and, you know, really gives, you know, the, you know, black demographic something to strive for as far as like the, an inspiration for a superhero movie. This does that, but like on a totally different level. Like it's for absolutely, you know, like everybody, and like the diversity here on display is incredible, just as far as not just the characters, but just like the kind of story it's telling and the way, you know, it weaves all of their stories together. And it's just, it's a totally mind-blowing cinematic experience that is unique visually. It's extremely funny. The wit here on display, from referencing old Spider-Man movies, you know, to the unique presentation of the different people with spider powers, and just all of this stuff. It's this perfect package, and I honestly couldn't love it anymore.
Yeah, the you know, the climactic action scene in this movie, I don't think is something that you could even possibly do in live action. Do you know what I mean? It's like so uniquely animated, you know, aside from the, you know, obviously the style of this film is so, you know, of its own and unique and something special. But I really believe that this is probably the first animated superhero film that I've seen that couldn't be accomplished in live action. And that's pretty cool. I was at Disneyland on Saturday, and we were at Disneyland with Kitra and one of her friends, Christina. And even though we were at the, you know, one of the happiest places on earth, we all decided, let's go watch this movie. So I saw this movie for a third time over the weekend. This time I paid. And I still love this as much as this is my favorite movie of the year. So this is going to be on our on our top 10 at the end of the year, I'm sure, between all of us. But Ben, you've already talked about this, but you did a bunch of interviews for this movie. We're going to record a special, integrating those interviews and stuff for either later this week or next. It depends on how news is this week, but, you can read them on slashfilm.com, but, look out for that. And, but speaking of Spider-Man, Chris, you also saw a Spider-Man movie.
yeah. So I finally watched Venom because I got the Blu-ray to review, and man, oh man. All right. So first of all, this movie is terrible. This is a terrible movie. The screenplay is atrocious, like to the point where I have trouble believing like this was even like written. Like I feel like they just showed up and just started filming and just like did it on the fly. Like everything happens in this movie is so poorly planned out and poorly thought out, and nothing really works. But with all that said, I kind of think Venom is worth watching just to see whatever it is that Tom Hardy is doing. I don't know what he's doing in this movie, but it's one of those like go for broke performances where he's like all in on it, and everyone else around him just looks really befuddled, and they're always like trying to keep up with whatever the hell it is he's doing. And it's so strange. Like, I don't want to say it's over the top, because it's not really over the top. It's just like, he just seems like he's out of his mind in this movie. And so I can't say I hated watching it, because I enjoyed watching him act like a lunatic. But if he weren't in the movie, it would be unwatchable, honestly. And I am shocked that this was such a huge hit. I don't know what the hell happened, but obviously I underestimated how much people really wanted to see a Venom movie.
I'm really curious if Venom 2 will do nearly as well. I think like a lot of people went into this. My theory is, Chris, that a lot of people like this character, and then a lot of people went into this thinking that Spider-Man was going to be in it, and that this was a Marvel movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. But like, if that were true, I feel like the box office should have died down. Yeah. Like, word of mouth should have gotten out saying, never mind, this isn't that good. And instead, it just got better and better, which suggests people were seeing this and saying, oh my God, you got to see Venom. It's really good. And if that's what happened, I'm alarmed. But, you know, that's the way things go, I guess. That's where we are as a society, where people are really excited to go see Venom.
Is it possible that people were coming out of this and telling their friends, you got to see this movie because I don't believe it exists and what Tom Hardy's doing? Or do you think we're just doomed as a people?
I honestly, all right. I did not want to get into this because I'm just like putting a target on my back. But Friday was the 1 year anniversary of The Last Jedi.
Oh,
and
no.
I made the foolish mistake of proclaiming my love for that movie on Twitter, which prompted so many people to go nuts and attack me. And I'm not talking, like, when I say attack, it sounds like I'm being dramatic, but these were people like flinging bile at me. Like, they were like wishing I was dead because I love The Last Jedi.
Jesus Christ.
And but right after I posted that tweet, I posted another tweet about Venom saying, like, boy, this movie is bad. And in addition to people yelling at me about The Last Jedi, I had people coming into that tweet and saying, you like The Last Jedi, but you hate Venom? Boy, you have poor taste. So at that point, I was like, all right, I give up on everything. Like, and this was, I had multiple people saying this, saying Venom is a better movie than The Last Jedi, and you're nuts for not.
No,
there were several people who said this. So at that point, I washed my hands of ever having an opinion again. So I'm retiring as of today. So I regret even bringing this up, because now people are going to hear this and yell at me some more, and it's exhausting. You know, if you're still this upset about The Last Jedi a year later, I don't know what to tell you. You really need to go into therapy and seek help, because it's not healthy to be this angry about a movie. And I don't understand what the end game is here, because, like, do you think, like, jumping into my mentions and calling me names is going to make me be like, oh, you're right, The Last Jedi sucks? Like, I, like, look, if you don't like The Last Jedi, that's fine. But I don't give a shit. Like, keep it to yourself. I don't care. You don't have to yell at me about it. All right, I'm done. I'm done talking about that.
The weird thing here, Chris, is these people, I'm betting if you look, they're not people that follow you for the most part.
No, I don't know who any of these people are. They found me somehow.
What happens is they get you, your tweet gets retweeted into their circle of, like, right, Venom, and then they go on an attack. It's like this big mob, and it's the same thing you see in, like, the circle of Snyder fans and, you know, DCEU, and I don't understand how it exists. Like, I almost want to believe that they're bots or something, but, you know, it's so poorly written to be bots.
I don't know. It's exhausting. And I like I said, I don't want to, cause I'm literally, like, I'm inviting them to come attack me more now, but it lasted. I posted that tweet on Friday. It lasted 3 days. Like, it just died down today, like, all weekend. And I kept muting the tweets, and even then they kept finding ways to catch my attention. And it's exhausting, man. Like, just, you know, I don't care if you don't like The Last Jedi. I love it. Like, you know, keep it to yourself. There's this weird belief on Twitter that things have to be debated. And I don't know where this idea comes from, where if someone said something, you have to, like, debate them. Like, no, like, just, like, I don't care. Like, leave me alone. That's all I'm gonna say. I'm done talking about The Last Jedi.
I just don't understand why people on Twitter or any social media or even the real world can't let you or anyone have this thing that they love, and, like, they try to ruin it. Like, you enjoyed this movie, and they have to rain on your parade. And you don't love a lot of things, Chris.
It's true.
Trying to ruin it.
I love very few things and people. No, yeah, it's like I said, you know, I talked about Venom. You know, I think that movie is bad, but if I saw someone on Twitter being like, Venom is the best movie ever. I would not jump into their replies and be like, you're an idiot. I'd be like, all right, whatever. It's like, just let people have it. Like, yeah. What?
You'd instead be like, unfollow.
Yeah, exactly. Let me mute you so I never have to see you again.
What other movies did you watch this week, Chris?
I also watched The House That Jack Built, which is the latest Lars von Trier movie that has been getting a lot of controversial buzz. It premiered at Cannes, and it got a very polarizing reaction there. And then they did a screening of the director's cut for one night only. And then they got in trouble with the MPAA. There was a whole thing. So the R-rated cut is now available to rent. And from what I hear, I have not seen the director's cut. From what I hear, though, they're almost identical. The director's cut is like 5 minutes longer, and it just includes just like a few more, you know, things here and there. So they're not that drastically different. So, I liked it. You know, I've seen very polarizing reactions to this. Some people think it's an abomination. Some people think it's good. I think I'm somewhere like in the middle. It's a little too long. It's like 2 hours and 30 minutes, which, you know, is pushing it. And it is a very unpleasant film because it's, you know, Matt Dillon plays a serial killer, and we follow him through his life as he, you know, commits some very heinous things, heinous acts. So it's definitely not, you know, the type of movie for everyone. I will say that, you know, I was expecting it to be a little more graphic than it was. Not that it's not graphic. There are a few very graphic moments of the film, but a lot of the violence happens sort of off screen. So I was expecting this like extreme splatter punk movie, and that's not what it is. It's a little more, I don't use the word classy because it's not really a classy movie, but it's a little more highbrow than that. But you know, it's good. It's not as bad as I've heard it is. It's not as good as I've heard it is either. But yeah, it's, if you like Lars von Trier movies, I think you'll enjoy this. I like some of his films. I really like Antichrist. I really like Melancholia. I did not really care for Nymphomaniac, but this is pretty much in line with most of his films.
Well, very cool. And you also saw Bird Box, which I'm not even sure what this movie is. I see these billboards around Los Angeles for it. This is a Netflix original?
Yes. Yeah, so Bird Box is based on a novel. I believe Jacob read the novel and he talked about it in the past on another Water Cooler episode. Bird Box is now playing in like a few theaters in New York and LA, and then on the 21st it hits Netflix for everyone. It's set in this, it's like this post-apocalyptic story where there are these creatures that if you see them, they drive you insane. It's like a Lovecraftian thing where, like, the, you know, they're beyond comprehension, and they, you know, they make you kill yourself basically. And the story is set in two different time periods. One is like directly after, you know, the event happens, and one is in the future where Sandra Bullock is traveling down this river with two children in tow. And, you know, they're wearing blindfolds because they, you know, they don't want to see the force and all, you know, so it's okay. The premise is really cool, and I think you could have done something really neat with the premise. And the problem is the movie is kind of, it's kind of like by the numbers. Like, it's very derivative of a dozen other movies. Like, if you've seen The Mist, or if you've seen even like The Happening, this movie has a lot in common with that, even like plot details. Like, there's a plot detail in this movie where one character is in the middle of a lawsuit with his neighbor over like some sort of property line, and that's literally in The Mist, to the point where I'm wondering if it was just put in there as a direct reference to it. I don't know like how else to explain it, but you know, it's okay. It's watchable. Sandra Bullock is good. It's got some generally creepy moments in it. Like, when it's hitting the horror, it does that really well, but everything in between the horror is a little lacking. But I liked it for the most part.
Well, very cool.
And I have a review on slashfilm.com. Please go click that review. Thank you.
We will link that in the show notes. Let's move on to what I've been watching. I've been still playing end of the year catch up So between, you know, me going to Disneyland and watching Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse way too many times, I've also, you know, been spending time at home trying to catch up on screeners and movies that are for rent on iTunes. One of those was Love, Simon. This is a movie by Greg Berlanti. Yeah, Berlanti. He's the screenwriter of Green Lantern. He directed Life as We Know It. He's responsible for a lot of TV, including Everwood and a bunch of those DC CW stuff that I don't watch and I judge from a distance, even though everybody tells me it's good.
They're good, Peter. Don't judge them.
I know.
Most part, they're good.
But he was also responsible for Green Lantern. So I have, you know, when this film came out, I was kind of thinking, you know, I kind of had low expectations for this. Yet I am a sucker for high school movies, coming of age movies, you know, high school set, you know, romance films. This one is surprising. It's surprisingly good. It's, I think what makes this better than your average high school movie is that it's not just a high school romance. There is a mystery involved. He's like trying to figure out who this person he's playing kind of like a virtual pen pal, a game of pen pal with is. This has so much heart and humor, like almost like a John Hughes film. It's charming. It manages to feel fresh and smart while still sticking to kind of like that traditional formula. You know, probably this is, I'm guessing this is probably the first mainstream gay romance film. Maybe? Am I wrong about that? At least said in high school, right?
No, you're right. Because that's what a lot of the sort of the attention and the acclaim around this movie was about.
And I anticipated that this film was going to kind of make itself about that and kind of play up, you know, oh, coming out to your parents and stuff. And I was kind of surprised that this movie, you know, plays with the same themes that other high school movies play with, you know, being alone in the crowd, you know, all the traditional stuff. And it's not to say that this isn't a love story from a gay a point of view, and it doesn't give that a different energy. It does. But I was surprised at how much I'm trying to find a way to put this, that it wasn't manipulative and not taking advantage of that kind of like, oh, we're the first one to do this in a way, you know, and we're going to play that up. It wasn't heavy handed. It's not a thing, and it just is. And I don't know. I kind of love that. And it just felt so, I don't know. It's great to see this kind of representation in Hollywood. It's the way it should be. And it's a movie that made me laugh and made me cry. I was so surprised by this movie. Has anybody else seen Love, Simon here?
I have. I really liked it when it came out. And yeah, I think that it feels revolutionary in the fact that it normalizes like this LGBT experience and into a film that is just kind of a more typical and almost formulaic teen rom-com. And in that way, it feels all the more revolutionary. And it's so heartwarming and it's so sweet. And I think for a while, it was like one of my favorite movies of the year, like halfway through. But it still packs like a good punch. Like it, some people could criticize it as being a little bit like saccharine at some points. And yes, it does get a little bit in that way. But I think the fact that it feels so universal while dealing with this very specific story is what makes it so appealing.
Yeah, I think right now it might be in my top 10. And I do understand people that would criticize this movie. Like you said, it is very formulaic and it is very whatever, but it just does it so well.
Yeah, I think that I saw it too. I watched it on a flight. And I think that's what kept me from really falling in love with it, is that it felt a little too formulaic. But at the same time, I did appreciate that it was like, it was a gay romance that was finally able to do like be a cliche romantic comedy, because we really haven't seen anything like that. And so it's still innovative in that way, despite being formulaic, but it still also simultaneously kept me from really like loving it as much as I otherwise might have.
Yeah, it definitely is trying to appeal more to a broad audience. It's not like a Sundance film. What else did I see? I saw, you know, speaking of Sundance, I saw Hearts Beat Loud, which stars Nick Offerman as a single dad, a Brooklyn hipster who starts a band with his teenage daughter and just before she leaves home to attend college. And without her knowing, he uploads a song to Spotify, and that song gains some traction and complicates things, I guess. I guess that's probably the plot synopsis for this film. This film did play at Sundance, and it does definitely feel like the typical Sundance movie, the kind of movie I love watching there. I'm a sucker for this kind of film, just as I'm a sucker for the, you know, coming-of-age film. This is so earnest and warm. Kirstie Clemons, who plays the daughter, is awesome in this. I've loved her since seeing her in 2015's Dope. I think she's going to have a huge career. You know, Nick Offerman does his thing. I really did like the score for this film, and I would recommend people seeing this, but I also think that this doesn't do anything, like, you know, too out of the norm. Like, if you've seen this kind of Sundance movie before, then, you know, you kind of know what this is. You know what you're getting yourself into. Brad, did you see this at Sundance, or was it Ben?
I did. No, yeah, no, we both did, actually. And we talked about it semi-recently, because I think Jacob watched it recently.
Yeah, I saw it last week.
Yeah, I think what makes it stand out, makes it a little bit better than your average sort of indie, you know, somewhat dysfunctional, estranged family movie, is that the soundtrack is really good because of the original songs that Nick Offerman and Kirstie Clemons performed together.
Yes.
And like the specificity of those scenes where they actually go through the motions of physically recording that stuff, as somebody who, you know, messes around with music in my spare time, that stuff really rang true to me too. And that's rare to see in a movie. And most of the time, movies don't really take the time to get those little details right. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah, no, I definitely recommend people check it out. It's probably in the top 20% of this year. Another film I saw was Leave No Trace. This is a movie starring Ben Foster and, I'm going to pronounce this name wrong, Thomasin McKenzie?
Yes.
Sounds more like a guy name than a girl name. So
that's
I thought,
the name of the character in The Witch, Thomasin.
Oh, okay. Thomasin. Fantastic performances from both of those actors. This movie is about Ben Foster, who is a veteran suffering from you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, and he kind of is raising his daughter in the woods. He doesn't want to live in a normal, you know, house environment. He homeschools her, and I guess the inciting incident is when someone finds them in the woods, and that sends their lives into complete disarray. This movie goes in directions you might not anticipate. It's heartbreaking, but not dire. It's about homelessness. It's about, it has some good performances. I'm not loving it as much as other people, I think, did this year. Has anybody else here seen this movie?
I have. I really love this movie. This might be one of my top movies of the year, actually, but I think it was just so profoundly like affecting and quiet that it left a big impact on me.
Now, I do like it. I highly recommend it. Again, I would say this in the top 20% of the year. And the performance is great. I think Thomasin McKenzie, I think, has a big future. I think she was great in this film. And yeah, that is all. Between that and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse for a third time, that is all that I watched this week. So, Brad, in addition to Spider-Man, what did you see?
I didn't see Spider-Man multiple times like you did, but I did see another superhero movie that I wasn't necessarily excited to see, but just felt obligated to see exactly how it turned out. And I went to the Amazon Prime sneak peek screening of Aquaman over the weekend. And I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed this movie. It's not great, but the action and visuals are entertaining enough that I was having a lot of fun with it. Jason Momoa is really good, as Aquaman. He's just this cool sort of, you know, bro Aquaman. And he doesn't feel like a douchebag. He just feels like a, you know, laid back, whatever kind of guy who's like, sure, I'll be a king, whatever. And it's, yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. There are definitely a handful of stupid movie stopping, terrible moments in this movie that it's just like, ugh, why did this happen? Including and not limited to a music video-esque slow motion shot of Aquaman and Mira walking onto a beach from the ocean set to the tune of Pitbull's awful cover of Toto's Africa, which is a real thing I said and actually exists. But otherwise, there's a lot of really fun things in this movie, and I just had a good time watching it. But like I said, there are several bad things that made me laugh and took me out of the moment that keep it from being really great. But it's easily one of the more enjoyable experiences as far as DC comic movies are concerned. And I would say it's a little bit more enjoyable than Wonder Woman, only because it's more fun and Wonder Woman is more somber, but Wonder Woman is definitely a much better crafted movie.
Do you think the worst parts of this are worse than Wonder Woman, or how does that compare?
The worst parts of this are definitely worse than the worst parts of Wonder Woman. But I think that where Aquaman succeeds is I think the action is crafted in a much more impressive and visually stunning way as opposed to the action in Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman does have some great action moments, including the No Man's Land sequence, but where it stumbles is in that third act, and I think the third act of Aquaman really delivers some great epic action.
Ben, you also saw Aquaman this week.
I did, and I didn't like it nearly as much as Brad. I felt like the moments that he was talking about where it's sort of the movie grinds to a halt and like all the formulaic aspects, that's the stuff that I really like took away from the movie. That's the stuff that hit me the most. I didn't particularly care for Momoa because I felt like his character, like there wasn't much of a character there behind his sort of like shruggy charisma, his bro-y attitude. I felt like I was never really able to latch on to him as a character and like get behind him and try to, I guess, root for him, for lack of a better term. I feel like in every shot of this movie, there is 40% too much happening. Like there is just so much going on in the background of every shot, like all of the establishing shots of the underwater cities and all of that stuff. It is just like visual overload. And I mean, I
love
guess it,
that. It's like Avatar meets Tron Legacy.
I
got that vibe several times too, where I just, the world just felt really full and complete to me, and I really like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example of how this works for some people and just did not for me, because I felt like I wanted to, you know, be in awe at the scenery, at the production design, and like the visual effects and all that stuff. But I just felt like, and this makes me sound so old, but I just felt like there was too much happening. Like, slow it down a little bit, you know, take 40% of that away and actually let me focus on some of these things. And maybe I would have experienced that awe that I think the movie wanted me to feel. But and then just, you know, all of the character dynamics, all of the dialogue, everything just felt so by the book to me, and there wasn't the few action moments that James Wan really like steps it up and makes interesting were not nearly enough to overwhelm the rest of the movie for me. I think every part of this is way worse than anything in Wonder Woman, but that's just me.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
I'll based on your reaction there, Peter, I think I think I should probably amend that to say that like the final battle in Wonder Woman is, as we've mentioned many, many times, not very good. Some of the one take action scenes in this are better than that. But in terms of like the characters and the
like Black Manta, it's a better villain than, you know, the villain in Wonder Woman, which I won't spoil.
He just gets sidelined so quickly and disappears for a huge chunk of the movie that, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Yeah, I mean, he would be a better villain if he were the primary villain. I know that's something that you said.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, actually, because I did like him in the role. What's his name?
man, I don't remember the actor's name off the top of my head, but he, I mean, his performance was great. And like, I actually liked the setup and everything in the submarine in the beginning, where you sort of like really understand the formation of him and sort of why he does what he does. I felt like that was one of the best parts of the movie, actually, because it's one of the few times that they really stopped to establish clear motivations that actually made sense to me. And the rest of it is just sort of like this mishmash hodgepodge of like Indiana Jones set pieces that like feel like they don't belong in this kind of a story, and a lot of just run of the mill stuff that you would expect an algorithm to write, you know, it's just like plug in superhero cliches here. And the movie just sort of leans into those. And yeah, it has an octopus that plays the drums, but like that's only in the movie for 1 second. And if there were, I don't know, more moments of specificity and instead of these cliches, then I think I would have reacted a lot better to it. But I just, this movie was not for me.
The actor who plays Black Manta is Yahya Abdul-Mateen II.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and one other thing that I forgot to say too is that, one thing that I was kind of surprised by in this movie is the action in this movie when it comes to the fight sequences felt so much more hard-hitting than any other superhero movie I've seen in recent memory. Like, I don't know if it was the sound design that did this or what, but you feel like the hits whenever Aquaman like punches or slams somebody into something. And there's also some surprisingly gruesome deaths and sequences too, where like whether it's a monster that's like getting you know, shot by a harpoon gun, or a person getting torn in half by another monster. I was surprised by how much James Wan pushed it, and like it seems like he brought a little bit of the horror sensibilities to this movie in that, which felt a little refreshing to me.
No, I think I'm more leaning towards what Brad is saying here with his reaction, but I don't know. I feel like even I was kind of not as positive on this movie as HG and some of the other people who saw this film. Anyways, Brad, I mean, yeah, Brad, what else have you been watching?
I also took the time to, I've been trying to catch up on some more low-key releases that are only playing at a distance from me right now over in Chicago. So I went into to the city yesterday to check out Ben Is Back, which is a harrowing tale of this family over the span of basically 24 hours, where Lucas Hedges plays this kid who comes back home for Christmas from a rehab center he's at, where he's being treated for drug addiction. And it's a total surprise to his family. His mother's played by Julia Roberts. But the family's kind of concerned about him being back, because this has happened a couple times before where he's come back and kind of ruined their holidays because he's a serious addict. And there are dangerous people who he had surrounded himself with before. And it's just – it's a very – anxiety-inducing, dramatic, emotional movie. Lucas Hedges and Julie Roberts are fantastic in it. The way the story plays out over the 24 hours as he's trying to kind of be comfortable with his family and resist like his temptation to fall into the old way of like, you know, finding drugs or like even just the craving of it, and how his family kind of tiptoes around him and is also very cautious and anxious about, you know, him relapsing. And there's a lot to it, and it's just I really liked it a lot. It was very compelling, very well acted, and it's definitely a harder hitting movie. I'd also be interested to find out whether or not Jacob thinks this is a Christmas movie or not, because it is entirely set at Christmas and unfolds across Christmas Eve into Christmas Day. But yeah, it's I was very impressed by it, and I think it. Lucas Hedges and Julie Roberts will probably be in the running for awards for their performances, because they're both phenomenal in this movie.
Jacob, is it a Christmas movie, or you haven't seen it yet?
I have not seen it. I will, when I do watch it, I will report back.
It's definitely not the kind of Christmas movie you're going to want to watch every year.
I feel like this is going to be a regular thing where we ask if Jacob thinks or it makes the final judgment if something is a Christmas movie or not. You also saw a movie I saw last week, Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yeah, speaking of Christmas movies, I had been very interested to see this ever since it played Fantastic Fest. Was it Fantastic Fest or was it South by?
It was Fantastic Fest last year.
Yeah. Oh, last year even. Wow, crazy. So, yeah, I've been waiting to see this just because the premise itself is so fun and something we haven't seen before. It is a high school set, Christmas set, zombie apocalypse musical. And it's very fun and delightful, but I didn't love it as much as I was hoping to. I really enjoy the soundtrack, and I like what they're going for, but I found myself wanting the movie to be a little bit more clever and original. And sure, it might be original enough to make an attempt at doing a holiday-themed high school musical where a zombie apocalypse is happening, but it felt like it kind of started to go off the rails a bit towards the end. And I feel like for as hard as it tries to earn a lot of emotional beats between the characters, I don't think it ever really fully makes you fall in love with any of the characters to actually be on board with any of the triumphs or struggles that they have as they have to face death and relationship struggles and that kind of thing. Part of me wonders if maybe it's just, I had this thought of that maybe just Shaun of the Dead is too perfect of a movie, and I love it so much that it's kind of made it difficult for other movies that are in a similar genre and take a similar approach to actually land as well as they otherwise might if Shaun of the Dead didn't exist. But I still had fun with it. It's one of those movies where it'll undoubtedly be a cult favorite for years to come. And again, the original songs for this movie are quite great, but I do think it lost sight of the musical aspect a little bit in the middle and towards the end, and then tried to pick it back up at the last minute, being like, oh, wait, this is supposed to be a musical.
Yeah, I think that first half, though, is so good. Like, I was, like, in the movie for the first half, like, being like, this is going to be in my top half of the year. Top 10 list. And then that second half, I like you said, takes a nosedive. I'm almost curious what HT is going to think of this movie, because I feel like that first half is so good with the high school stuff. And driving to Disneyland, we were listening to the soundtrack. The music in the movie is actually quite good. I tried listening to the Mary Poppins soundtrack and I just couldn't do it. So I enjoyed it. But let's move on to Ben. Ben, besides Aquaman, what have you been watching?
So I watched another pretty formulaic blockbuster, and that is Bumblebee. I'll say right off the top, it's the best Transformers movie. I, like you, Peter, like it even more than the first Transformers, which I don't find nearly as objectionable as many people. I feel like that's one of those that that worked really well when it came out in 2007, and since then it's sort of been lumped in with the rest of the Transformers movies, but I feel like the first one's still pretty decent. This one gets back to the heart, which is something that I felt like Aquaman didn't have at all, but Bumblebee has a huge heart, and it's a story that you've seen a million times before, but just told with a Transformers skeleton over the top of it, I guess. And it's Haley Steinfeld is fun. It's exactly what you want it to be. If you're looking forward to this movie, you're going to like it. It's funny in all the right ways, but it's And the action is actually a lot smoother and cleaner than a lot of the Michael Bay Transformers films. So that was a pleasant surprise. This is a step up in every way from all of the other Transformers movies, even the first one. But it's one of those that's so right down the middle that you can predict every beat, minutes before it happens. Like, it's very obvious exactly what's going to happen and why and how. There's no surprise to this movie other than like, oh, hey, it's a Transformers movie that's actually like pretty decent. That's Bumblebee. I don't know if anybody else has seen this one or has any other observations about it.
I know Chris is not going to go see this, and he's going to wait until home video, despite everybody saying it's good.
Yes, or longer.
I think that's a good call, Chris.
I wanted to see it so he could be the one person that does not like this movie.
I mean, I don't know if I would say that I liked it. It's fine. Okay, so moving on. Minding the Gap. This movie's on Hulu right now. I would recommend that people check this out if you haven't seen it. It's really like... it's a very impressive piece of work. It's a little shapeless, I think. I wish it had a little bit more of a directness to the approach. It feels like it's a little bit of a Shaggy movie at times. But this documentary about a group of kids who grew up skateboarding together, and then the doc sort of picks up with them years later and tracks the emotional toll and economic toll, and really the toll overall that domestic abuse has played in their lives. And it's not quite as harrowing as that description makes it sound. There's some funny stuff in here. The tone is generally, fairly light. But it also grapples with issues that I feel like are not really discussed in a meaningful way in movies today. The director Bing Liu is also, he was one of this crew, the skateboarding crew, and he realized that his mom married this guy who abused him when he was a kid, and that affected him in such a way that he wanted to take a wider look, not just at his small circle of friends, but also this town in Illinois that they live, and try to figure out, get to the root of what is going on with this issue. And it's a wide ranging kind of thing. But at the same time, it's very specific to this group of people. It's very good. It sort of defies description in a lot of ways. Like I said, I wish it had a little bit more of a punch to it in terms of the way that the story is told, and doesn't quite go off on so many little tangents. But overall, I would recommend it. It's good. I don't think it's going to make my favorite movies of the year, but it's very good, and it's certainly one of the better documentaries that's out there and easily available right now. And that one's on Hulu. I also saw Destroyer, which is the new Nicole Kidman movie that's coming up. I think that one comes to theaters on Christmas Day. I went to a film independent screening where Karin Kusama, the director, was there afterwards, and she was there with the writers and talked about the movie. And it's a very, very good movie. I think Nicole Kidman is phenomenal in this movie. It's a modern LA noir it takes place over parallel narratives where she's trying to track the events of a case that's happening in real time. And then it flashes back to when she was undercover working with the same group of bad guys, basically. And it's a very straightforward kind of no nonsense cop thriller in the vein of a Michael Mann kind of thing. So if you're interested in those kinds of movies, I feel like this one's really gonna stick out to you. It's worth putting on your radar for Nicole Kidman's performance alone, really. But Sebastian Stan is also really good in this movie too. And I just really like what Kusama did with this one. It's a really solid LA movie, and I liked the action. There's a bank robbery sequence that's very effective, and I just enjoyed this one a lot. Chris, I know you saw this one too, right?
Yeah, I saw that TIFF, and I loved it. I've actually just got really mixed reactions. Like, almost everyone I talked to at TIFF said they didn't like it, but this is actually in my top 10. I really love this movie. Everything you said, I pretty much agree with 100%.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction at Fantastic Fest, where I was very much alone and thinking it was fantastic. So I think that what we've learned here is that Slash Film has the best taste.
Yeah, there's something in the Slash Film water cooler that makes us all on board for this movie, I guess. So moving on, I saw Free Solo as well. And this one is still in some theaters. You'll have to check your local listings to see if it's in theaters near you still. But it came out earlier this year. It is a documentary about a rock climber named Alex Honnold, who tries to climb El Capitan, which is this huge rock face in Yosemite National Park in California. He climbs it without any rope. So that's the term free solo. It's just climbing this thing without any protection at all. So if you take one wrong step, you're dead. And there's a camera crew that's on the mountainside with him. And I was almost as impressed with those guys as I was at the, incredible feat that this guy is trying to attempt of climbing this whole thing, just because they're also climbing, but they're also filming. I mean, they have ropes, of course, but they're not totally insane. But they're also able to get some really incredible shots of this guy performing what, this thing that no human should ever undergo. And it's super tense. My palms were sweating. It gives you a visceral reaction. It's very, very tense. And this is one of those documentaries that I feel like the subject matter is super interesting, but the documentary itself and the way it's actually constructed and put together left a little bit to be desired for me. So it's not like, it's not an amazing documentary, but it's an amazing thing that the documentary is chronicling, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I would still, even though I have some qualms with the way the thing is put together, and I sort of wish that they would give us more information along the way in terms of like how long it would take him to climb, or, you know, how long has it taken him to get to this point, or like some comparisons for size and things like that. Just like some sort of basic things to help you really understand the enormity of what he's actually doing. Even with my little qualms, I feel like I could easily recommend this to anybody. It's actually a National Geographic documentary, so I'm guessing it's going to be available maybe on the National Geographic channel or something like that at some point soon. So if you can't catch it in theaters, just, I don't know, eventually search your DVR, see if you can find it there. It's called Free Solo, and it's worth watching, I think.
I haven't seen this, but hearing your description of this, Ben, it doesn't seem heroic to do. Like, this seems stupid. This seems irresponsible make that climb without any safety net of a, like, I understand, like, you know, you want to do it by hand and not like use the rope to, like, you know, rely on that tension and stuff like that, but he literally has nothing to save him if he were to fall.
Yes, that's correct. And they grapple with that, and the movie grapples with that in the very beginning. Like, one of the first things is like somebody in a news interview saying, so let me get this straight. If you slip, you die. And he's like, yeah, you got it. You understand what I'm going for here. And, you know, the guy, it's much of a character study of the climber as it is a chronicling of his attempt to do this totally insane thing that, by the way, no human has ever done before. Yeah, it's interesting in the, like I said, in the subject matter. I wish that the execution was a little bit better, but yes, it does get into some of the mentality and some of the, you know, the reasoning behind why somebody would attempt to do something crazy like this.
What would they have done if he did fall and die?
That's one of the other things that I really liked about the documentary is that it takes a step back and looks at, it interviews the camera people and shows the cameraman and the director, I think, or co-director, like, it shows them on camera talking about how nervous they are about doing this because they don't want to be responsible for putting the camera in a certain place that would distract him and maybe cause him to slip up and fall off and die. And like that, it's a really, really tense, suspenseful documentary that I think you guys would probably like. It there's, like I said, there's some small quibbles with it, but for the most part, I think it's definitely worth watching. It's like it's a pretty brisk watch, and subject matter, it's 96 minutes long, so it's not asking too much of your time, and the subject matter is just so fascinating. And like I said, that visceral reaction, like, I was, my wife and I watched us sitting at home on the couch together, but I was like watching it through my fingers for a lot of it because it's just so insane. Some of the shots are able to get.
Cool. What else have you been watching?
I caught up with The Favorite, which I know a lot of people talked about last week on the podcast. I won't go too long on that. I thought this movie was hilarious. I was really, I was a big fan of The Lobster, Yorgos Lanthimos' movie from a few years ago. And this one is way funnier than that. And so I really appreciated that part of it. I think all of the performances are really good. I was talking to my wife afterwards and I was like, you know, this is the definition of like a, oh yeah, it's really good. But a movie where it's like, okay, this is a solid 7.5, but I just won't watch this again. I feel like it doesn't have any rewatchability, and I'm glad that I saw it, but it's not anything that I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to go back and revisit that. And not that that's like the end all be all of like what makes a movie good or anything like that, but it just, you know, I'm glad I saw it. I think the performances are all very good. It has some.
But you do realize you are in the minority here.
Yes,
most
of
people
course.
Think this is one of the best, like, if not the best movie of the year, one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if I were making a list, it would probably be like in my top 15 or something. You know, maybe like number 15 if I were to actually make that list. I haven't done that yet, but I enjoyed it a lot. I just don't think I'm not head over heels for it in the way that several people seem to be, where it's like, you know, top three of the year or anything like that. I just think the script, the writing is so great. All of the insults and the cutting lines by Rachel Weisz's character are, you know, so much fun to watch. The movie actually, I think, has some, I'm really grappling with it still, because I just saw it a couple days ago, and I'm trying to wrap my head around its larger meanings and like what it's really about and really trying to say. So maybe I'll end up liking it more in retrospect once I sort of really settle on what I think the movie is trying to say and do. But in, you know, just on a surface level, I really enjoyed what I saw. And maybe it'll, yeah, like I said, maybe it'll rise in my estimation once if I come up with like some ultimate reading of the movie that I haven't landed on yet. But yeah, it's definitely worth checking out if anybody's on the fence about The Favorite. It's got some really, really good stuff in it, and that one's in theaters right now too. And then lastly, I saw Roma, which is available on Netflix. I know it's, I feel bad because I'm living in LA, which is one of the few cities where it's playing in theaters, and I couldn't bring myself to pay, you know, $45 or whatever to go see the movie with my wife in theaters when we have it, especially because our theatrical experience at The Favorite was so, like, this woman fell asleep in front of us, in the row in front of us, and was snoring during the movie. People, the guy next to me had his phone out the whole time. So it was like, do we really want to do that again? No, well, let's just stay home and watch this on Netflix. So we watched Roma, and it's very, very good. It's, you know, I think this is one of the movies that people are saying like is one of the films of this year. And I was listening to the DGA podcast. The Directors Guild of America has a podcast, and Alfonso Cuarón, the director, was being interviewed by Alejandro González Iñárritu. And Iñárritu was saying that when he watched Roma, it felt to him like the beginnings of a river. It was like the movie begins with a single drop of water, and then slowly more and more water accumulates, and it just becomes, by the end, it becomes this full flowing river. And I feel like that's a really good way to describe my relationship with this movie. I feel like it took me a while to really understand the film's rhythms, and then once something, I'm not even going to say what it is, happens to the lead character, this big event happens to her, and she experiences this huge life-changing thing, I was like fully on board with it for the whole rest of the movie. But it took a little while to get there. So I don't know, I would say be patient with this one. If you're watching it and sort of like, if you feel antsy in the beginning of it, I would say give it time, because it deserves your full attention.
See, I feel like the last two movies you mentioned are very indicative of how I felt about this year. And we'll discuss this later when we do our top 10 episode. But I feel like there's a lot of really good movies that I don't really want to rewatch. Like, yeah, Roma is a great movie. I would even say that's a great movie. But I don't think, you know, I'll rewatch it in 10 years.
Yeah. I agree. And that's, again, like I was saying before, just because something is not rewatchable doesn't make it really like lower in quality or anything. But I agree. There's something, you know, it's all about what you value as a movie watcher. And I tend to value things that are, you know, fun and breezy and light and easily rewatchable. So but, you know, that's just one aspect of a thing that I like as a movie watcher. So yeah, certainly I won't be returning to The Favorite or Roma anytime soon, but yeah, I enjoyed them both.
Yeah, I love stories that I can revisit over and over again. HJ, what have you watched this week?
So I haven't watched caught up with quite that many new films this week for some reason, but I did catch a Netflix original film that came out this year. And I featured it on my pop culture imports column. If you guys want to read that, maybe drop that in the show notes. But it's an Italian fantasy film that is, I feel like, hasn't got as much attention, awards attention, or like best of the year attention because of all of the hype that's surrounding Roma. But if anything, it deserves just as much as Roma. It's such a strange, offbeat, surreal film. It's kind of like Italian neorealism meets magical realism, and wrapped up in this Rip Van Winkle tale about this 20-year-old sharecropper named Lazaro, who is incredibly naive and just a very happy person, as the title indicates, and one day falls off a cliff and wakes up like 20 years later, unaged, and reunites with all the other sharecroppers who he worked with, and discovers that the world has, in his absence, kind of become more grimy and grim, and much more like real, like reality has set in. But it maintains this weird magical realism to the film, despite kind of becoming like this anti-capitalist manifesto. It's really good. It's very strange, but I liked it quite a lot. And it's definitely like a modern day fairy tale meets like the Italian neorealism films of the 60s or 70s. So it's good. It's on Netflix. And I've been saying this, I feel like I've been saying this a lot this episode, but it might end up on my top movies of the year just because it's so up my alley. I've talked before about how much I love fairy tales and magical realism. And this really captures that, just sort of stream of consciousness, magical realism type of genre. I highly recommend it. It's on Netflix. And then I watched another film that was not from this year, but I didn't get to see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, but I did end up writing a column about the most beautiful animated films of all time. And my number one pick was a film I just saw right before I wrote this column, and it's called The Garden of Words. It's directed by Makoto Shinkai, who directed the last year's mega hit anime, Your Name. And it's definitely the most beautiful film that he's ever made. He has a tendency to depict like mundane sort of settings in this photorealistic manner that makes like regular Tokyo streets look just magical and enchanting and just like the most beautiful thing. And The Garden of Words follows these two people, a 15-year-old boy student and a 27-year-old woman who keep accidentally meeting at this garden on rainy mornings when they take shelter from the rain. And it kind of follows their frequent kind of coincidental meetings and their relationship as they sort of, you know, come to know each other and stuff. And it's a very short, simple, and quiet film, but the animation is just stunning. And the way that Makoto Shinkai depicts rain on screen is probably the most beautiful way I've ever seen rain in live action or in animation, which just sounds like a weird thing to comment on, but it's just a gorgeous film, and I highly recommend it. It's only 40 minutes long, too, if you ever want to check it out.
So it's not even really a feature film.
It's not really a feature film, but it was released as a feature film.
Yeah.
But it's more like a short film.
Okay, I have a question for you, because most Americans, sadly, probably will only see at most one anime film a year. Mm-hmm. Is this the film of this year?
Oh, the anime film of this year. So Garden of Words is an older film, and so it didn't come out this year.
Oh, it didn't come out this year. Sorry.
No, it didn't come out this year. The anime film I would recommend this year is Mirai, directed by Mamoru Hosoda.
Yes.
Who directed The Girl Who Left Her Time and
You talked
Boy
about
the
this
Beast.
In the past episode, right?
I have talked about this in the past. So that would be the film I recommend this year. It's really great. It's funny and kooky and also very tender and contemplative. That's the one I recommend for this year if you were to catch an anime film.
Yeah, it's on my to-do list because of you.
Yes. Yeah. Watch it, everyone.
Yeah. And you've also been doing some other holiday rewatching?
Yes. So I know this is a film that Ben sincerely hates, but it's a movie that I love to watch every year and every Christmas, rather. And my friends and I had gathered to kind of do a watch of it and introduce it to some of our other friends who had never seen it before. Two guys, of course. And they enjoyed it.
You're talking about Love Actually. I don't think you said that.
Sorry. I forgot to say it. Love Actually. They enjoyed it, Ben. It's not like a good movie by any means. And it's intensely problematic by today's standards. But it's just so fun and charming. And it's got such a great cast. And Richard Curtis, the director of this film, who directs other rom-com classics like Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, I think is able to put together this ensemble in a way that it is much more like put together and seamless rather than like all the other ensemble movies that came out in the wake of this film. And yeah, while some of the segments don't really, you know, hold up today, it's still such a fun rom-com escapist film, and that's what I want in a rom-com. So all these little vignettes with great actors just enjoying their time and, you know, delivering some truly, truly like ridiculous lines.
I am going to take Chris's advice here, since he's the one who runs an advice corner after all, and just sit back and let you have this one. I'm not going to jump into your mentions about this. I'm just going to say I'm glad you enjoyed your rewatching of Love Actually.
I'd like to add that I am on HT's side with this, because I also really enjoy rewatching Love Actually around the holidays, despite the fact that some things haven't aged well. I just love the cast, and there's some really fun stuff in it.
So there you have it. Ben does not love love. And let's move on to what we've been eating. As you know, I've been on this weird keto diet for the last 2 months. I've lost almost 30 pounds at this point. I'm not going to bore you with the diet, but there's been a few things I discovered this week that I want to share for those of you who might be trying to eat less carbs or less sugar. I discovered this ice cream called Rebel Creamery ice cream, and this is something you can find. I got it at Lawson's, which is kind of like this almost like upscale Whole Foods kind of place, but they have it at a bunch of supermarkets. You can order it from their website, and this is a cream based ice cream. It's very creamy. It's 5 to 8 carbs per serving. That's a 1/4 of the pint. It uses some sugar alcohols that don't affect your blood sugar levels. It's the closest to ice cream I've tried on a, you know, that has a low carb diet. I actually think I might like it better than Halo Top, and it's a lot less carbs than Halo Top. It still is not ice cream, so I'm sure Brad would try it and be like, bullshit. But if you're trying to eat better, I highly recommend this. My favorite flavors are peanut butter, fudge, and mint chocolate chip, although they do have a cookie dough and coffee chip, which I have not tried. So, check out Rebel Creamery. I'll link it in the show notes. And the other thing I discovered, Target started selling Quest frozen pizzas. You might know Quest because they produce these Quest bars, which are kind of like these low-carb meal replacement bars, which I like. Actually, Jacob was the one that turned me on to those, and now they produce these frozen cheese pizzas. It's a thin crust cheese pizza. They have a bunch of different flavors. I mean, a bunch of different varieties. The one I like is the 4 cheese pizza. It's 6 net carbs per serving, 330 calories. So that's like a half a pizza. So if you're going to be realistic, you're probably going to eat the full small pizza, and that's like 12 carbs and, you know, 600 calories. Still not that bad. I this isn't going to compete with your local pizza delivery of your choice, but this is better than any of the frozen pizzas I've ever had. And I've had some bad frozen, I've had some good frozen pizzas and some bad frozen pizzas. So I'd highly recommend this. You can get it at Target. It's called Quest Pizza, and it's in their frozen aisle. Brad, what have you been eating recently?
Nothing too special, but I did get my hand on a new Ghirardelli chocolate squares flavor. It's toffee and cookie crunch. If you've seen the Ghirardelli chocolate squares around, you know what these are. Every holiday season, they have certain flavors that come back, like the peppermint bark ones, and like there's a peppermint brownie one, I think, as well. There's several ones that only come out around the holidays. This is a new one that they released for the winter season, and it's pretty good. It's got a nice crunch to it. It has just enough toffee in it to give it a nice toffee flavor without being overpowering. I like that it has a little less toffee than like a Heath bar would, because sometimes a Heath bar can be a little too chewy because of how much toffee is in it. So yeah, the toffee and cookie is a nice mix with the Ghirardelli chocolate, which is always delicious. So yeah, if you can find these in like I found mine in the seasonal section at Target, and you should be able to find them in any of the seasonal candy sections at whatever store you get your holiday candy from.
Very cool. Let's move on to our last section, and that's what we've been playing. Jacob, what have you been playing this week?
Not playing anything, but designing a game, and or specifically designing a game session. When I go home for the holidays, my brother, his wife, my sister, and her husband all want to play tabletop RPG. So I'm bringing Scum and Villainy, which is a sci-fi game, and I'm going to design a one session adventure for everybody to go on. If you remember from a long time ago on this podcast, talk about a game called Blades in the Dark, a fantasy adventure game. And Scum and Villainy is a hack of that game, which is RPG talk for it. It takes the basic skeleton of Blades in the Dark and adds a new theme, adds new elements, and takes all the really satisfying mechanics, stuff that make Blades in the Dark such an incredibly satisfying and fun to play game. But instead of making it dark fantasy, it puts you in a spaceship and lets you fly around the galaxy. There's a bounty hunter, criminals, or as rebels going in all kinds of adventures. And I'll have a full report on how this goes in a few weeks on the water cooler. If it goes poorly or if it goes well, I will report back. But I do know that if you want like a good RPG system, one that like is incredibly cinematic and keeps on upping the ante for tension and things going wrong in ways to keep the story going forward, both Blades in the Dark and Scum and Villainy are like the same thing. They're both great, just if you prefer fantasy or sci-fi. But I'll let you know how it goes.
How are they able to operate? I feel like Disney must own the trademark for Scum and Villainy at this point, right?
I don't know. I mean, I would assume that I would assume the authors chose that title knowing it would conjure those Star Wars feelings.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know how Disney can get away with conjuring something that's, you know, just a throwaway line of dialogue and, you know, two very common words. So,
okay, I think this is officially the longest episode of the Water Cooler. We've gone over, I think, an hour and 40 minutes at this point. So we're going to end it here. You can find more of all of our work on SlashFilm.com. You can find links to those features I mentioned in the show notes. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, or life advice from Chris to peter@slashfilm.com. That's peter@slashfilm.com. And please go rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Hey, Peter.
See, I need to get that no button. Like, this I got to respond. I got to steal your no button.
Well, no button was found at Target, if that helps. I've opened up Louis A. Safian's gargantuan book of insult, offense, and effrontery, as is tradition, grand tradition here on Slash Film Daily, to the boozers chapter. So I have some great truths to reveal about all of your alcohol habits. Who wants to go first?
Me.
Hey, Brad, you believe in a balanced diet, a highball in each hand.
Oh, boy. I love that Ben volunteered, but I was the one who got shot first.
Oh, I misunderstood that. I thought that was Brad.
I guess I said it in a Bradish tone, so I could see the confusion.
Well, I'll do Ben next, because at the party, he never plays spin the bottle, because he won't let go of it.
Damn.
Well, HT, her eyes and nose are so red, the Communist Party sent her a membership card.
That actually makes sense because, like, Asian glow.
Well, Chris, he's an outstanding candidate for the Alcohol of Fame.
What? All right.
Hall of Fame.
Oh.
Alcohol of Fame.
Now I get it. Now
alcohol. Alcohol.
All right.
Of Fame.
All right.
Where's that no button?
Oh, no.
Okay. And finally, Peter, the way liquor makes him fly, bartenders are asking him to land some other place.
All the time. Every week. I don't know.
No.
I'm so drunk right now.
Okay, guys. It's 2 p.m. We need to call an end to this water cooler session. We need to get back to work.
We've been recording since 11 a.m.
I know.
We did take a break, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, does anybody have something funny to end this off with?
No. 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 No.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.